Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to CAF Chats. I am Major Rhianne Wentz, and today I am joined by
Major Andrew Britt.
Major Britt, welcome to the department. You are one of our new faculty members, and this is your first time on CAF Chats, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I am coming from the LLM program at UVA to now an associate professor on faculty. Before that, I was in the graduate degree program. And then before that, I spent 3 years at the Army's Defense Appellate Division. Prior to that, I had 2 years prosecuting, once with 2nd Infantry Division and another with 8th Army.
Awesome. Thank you. So CAF released 4 decisions in the last couple of weeks, and we will be discussing United States versus Harberth out of the Navy. So there's a lot to cover, so let's get into it. We'll talk about the procedural history and the facts first. So Harberth was a contested panel trial. The accused was convicted of 3 specifications of indecent visual recording in violation of Article 120 Charlie, and 1 specification of producing child pornography in violation of Article 134. The members sentenced the accused to confinement for 18 months and a bad conduct discharge. The general nature of the misconduct concerns the accused using his in-home security system to secretly record nude images of his underage stepdaughter and her friend. The legal issues center around alleged Fourth Amendment violations and related ineffectiveness of counsel claims in relation to the seizure of the devices that contained evidence of the crimes. So this all starts with the accused and his wife were in the car and they were having this heated exchange over his alleged infidelity. And his wife asked to see his phone. And while the accused declined to hand it over, his stepdaughter took the phone out of his hand and gave it to Harberth's wife. The wife and daughter go through the phone, finding in the deleted photo section images from an in-home security camera depicting the daughter changing clothes in her bedroom. The wife contacted civilian police who arrived at the house and encountered the accused. The accused tells the responding police officer that, quote, "It's bad. I need help. You should just arrest me now." Inside the house, the wife shows the officer the 4 photos on the iPhone that she'd taken in the car to include a nude image of the daughter. After she showed the officer the photos and the law enforcement officer departed, the wife went through an iPad 4, which was another device that the accused had at the house, where she found more nude recordings of her underage daughter. The wife then turned over the iPad and additional devices to civilian police. So essentially, Harberth's wife went through the house, found every single electronic device she could, and turned it over to, I think it was the Honolulu Police Department. NCIS then became involved because the Honolulu Police Department informed NCIS, and they took the lead on the investigation. The wife provided NCIS with even more devices of the accused, and they received the devices previously collected by civilian police. So at this point, the wife had collected several devices and had turned them all over to law enforcement. Law enforcement just kind of sat on them. And in part, it was when they were first collected, they weren't sure that they had probable cause to look at them. And so through a variety of reasons, one of which was that the case got transferred to another agent, took 94 days for NCIS to receive a search authorization on the devices. Now, after they received the search authorization, it yielded more than 100 additional videos from the security system that were saved on the accused phone, his iPhone XS, iPad 4, and an iPhone 6S. So at trial, the defense moved to suppress evidence from the search of the phone, the iPhone XS, and from the seizure of the other devices. The military judge at trial denied the motion. On direct appeal, the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals held that the accused waived the objection to the seizure of the iPhone XS, but the iPad 4 and iPhone 6 were seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment. For the 3 specifications of indecent recording, the NMCCA affirmed one, dismissed one with prejudice, and set aside the findings of the other. And the court also set aside the child pornography offense, set aside the sentencing, and authorized a rehearing. The Judge Advocate General of the Navy certified 5 issues of this case to CAF, and then the court granted review of a 6th issue raised by appellant. Andrew and I were talking before we started recording, and how these issues are phrased, how they are written, is kind of confusing. So we're just going to go through each of them in turn. So we're not going to go through all of the issues. CAF only answers three of the issues before the court because that renders the other three issues kind of moot. So first, CAF determined that the accused waived the objection to the duration of the seizure. Second, CAF determined that the actions of Harbert's wife as a private actor in taking the accused devices and giving them to law enforcement did not implicate the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable seizures because, as we'll discuss, we remember it has to be a government actor that violates the Fourth Amendment. Third, CAF concluded that the trial defense counsel were not ineffective because they failed to file the motion based upon the seizure of the devices, not just the search. And so, like I said, based upon these answers, the court declined to answer the three remaining certified issues. But we'll go through each of these issues in turn. So I'm going to do issue one, and then I promise I'll let you talk, Andrew. It's been a habit of mine to sort of forcibly take over these podcasts. But turning to issue one, CAF looked at whether the CCA erred in erred or erred.
What's your opinion? Erred.
Erred. I agree. Anybody who says erred, it doesn't make any sense to me. All right. Erred in failing to find that the accused waived objection to the duration of the seizure. So again, keep in mind it's the objection to the duration of the seizure, not necessarily the seizure itself, but how long the seizure was. Now, the pertinent rule here is Military Rule of Evidence 311 Delta 2 Alpha, which provides that a failure to object to suppression issues constitutes waiver. And importantly, in Perkins, which is a case that CAF cites here, held that MRE 311 Delta 2 Alpha requires a particularized objection. So even though the seizure questions as Fourth Amendment issues receive a presumption against waiver, CAF has said that presumption is overcome when the defense fails to make a particularized objection. So at trial for the iPhone XS, the defense objected only to the search, not the duration of the seizure. And without any objection to the seizure of this device, the defense waived the issue of the seizure's duration. For the accused other devices, the defense did object to the seizure, but only for lack of probable cause. Now, the CCA thought that this objection was enough to preserve the issue for the duration of the seizure. They relied on a 2017 DC Circuit case called Griffith, which found that probable cause objection at trial also preserved sort of an overbreadth issue on appeal. But the CAF disagreed with the CCA and distinguished Griffith, mainly because the new overbreadth argument, and when I say new overbreadth argument, it's new on appeal. So it wasn't made at trial and was only made on appeal. And part of the issue that CAF has and the appellate courts have is, you know, if you don't raise it at trial, there's no opportunity for the government to sort of develop those facts and answer that issue. Anyway, so CAF distinguishes Griffith mainly because the new overbreadth argument was based on the same facts as the probable cause objection, and the record was fully developed to decide the issue. For Harbert, though, the parties never litigated the reasonableness or unreasonableness of the duration of the seizure. So the record was not developed because the defense never raised the issue. So, you know, Chief Judge Olson just spoke at the military judge's graduation. He talks about the lack of the ability for appellate courts to develop the record. And so when we're talking about especially Fourth Amendment cases, when we're talking about search and seizure, the details and the fact finding and the record development are so incredibly important. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about sort of takeaways. But that's part of the rationale about why the appellate courts, you know, this has to be raised at trial, because at trial is the only place that we can develop these facts. So anyway, while this first issue didn't really make any substantive changes to the law and in CAF's determination of it, it still serves as an important reminder that even though seizures are constitutional concerns, failing to make particularized objections results in waiver. And this particularized objection requirement exists so the parties have this opportunity to sort of flesh out the evidence and the arguments at trial and forming a developed record for reviewing courts to consider on appeal. So the other big takeaway, I think, for practitioners is really the importance of remembering that we don't just care about the search. So I think a lot of times we just say search and seizure and we forget about the seizure part of it. And the seizure part of it is a whole nother analysis. Now, your ability to seize evidence is based on probable cause, and there's a lot of overlap in terms of what the rules are, but you have to think about the duration of the seizure, how it was seized, was it reasonable? And so practitioners really need to break down, okay, not only do we have to think about the search of this evidence, but how was it seized? How long was it seized? And again, this also goes back to developing the record and how important the facts are going to be to this case. And so if you read the facts section of Harbert, right, you have to think about the timeline. You have to think about who seized it. You have to think about all these sort of details. And so I think for practitioners, if you're dealing with a case like this, you need to map it out. You need to sit down and look at, okay, at this time, this person got it, and this is what they knew, right? And so you need to sort of build this out in a very specific way to understand how you're going to litigate this, because that's what your judge is going to need and what your judge is going to need to know. The other thing I think, for this is breaking down the evidence, right? So there were several different devices here. They were seized at different times under different contexts. And these situations are particularly dynamic. And so I think for practitioners, it's really going to be important to not only break down the timeline and the facts, but also by device. And when we're looking at even self-incrimination, we're looking at statements. You know, not all statements should be treated equally because these situations are dynamic. And so I really want to emphasize to the field that you've got to break down not only the facts and how it applies to sort of as the situation progresses, but also the individual pieces of evidence, right? So in this case, what I hope practitioners did, or if somebody has a case like this, is you need to look at each individual device and understand how was it seized, how long was it seized, who seized it, those kinds of, and be able to answer those questions to develop for the trial court in order for the judge to rule. Okay, enough about issue one. I now want to turn it over to Andrew to talk about issue two.
Thank you, Ryan. So on the second issue, the CAF is looking at whether the actions of the wife implicate the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable seizure. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable seizures, which generally is when a government agent meaningfully interferes with an individual's possessory interest in an object. So the CAF makes short work of this issue up front based on the general premise of the issue because the parties agree that the wife was not acting as a government agent. Since she's not a government agent, she cannot seize property for the Fourth Amendment purposes. The court then moves on, though, to an interrelated issue of whether the Fourth Amendment seizure concerns are triggered once the government took possession of the devices for their own purposes. Since the case involved multiple devices, as Rianne was mentioning, with varying levels of extrinsic evidence to support that the devices contained contraband, the CAF is able to resolve the entire question on broad exceptions to temporary seizures. Even assuming that the law enforcement's acceptance of the device would be a seizure, and the facts did not arise to probable cause for all the devices, there was at least sufficient reasonable suspicion of criminal activity to permit the temporary seizure of the devices. A few thoughts and takeaways on this issue. First, where there is a private actor taking property in which an accused has a reasonable expectation of privacy in its contents, then that private actor voluntarily turns the property over to law enforcement. The Fourth Amendment still demands the government obtain a search authorization to search the contents. There was a search authorization in this case, so it was not at issue, but CAF addressed this point in footnote 8. More generally, under these circumstances, where there is probable cause to believe the property contains contraband, then law enforcement's acceptance of the seized property is reasonable for Fourth Amendment purposes. In addition to a probable cause justification, CAF recognizes an exception based on the lower standard of reasonable suspicion. While this reasonable suspicion standard was applicable to this case, I'll highlight that it's in the narrow context where the accused had already waived the objection to the duration of the seizure that was addressed in the first issue. And I'd just like to point out that in the United States versus Place, the Supreme Court applied the framework for short duration Terry stops to the temporary seizure of a person's property based on reasonable suspicion. There, the 90-minute temporary seizure of a passenger's luggage was held to be unreasonable. So without the waiver of the duration issue, CAF may have been more deeply analyzing this issue based on whether or not it met the probable cause standard, but really not at play in this case just because that issue was waived. Next, turning to the third and final issue that was addressed by CAF, it concerns whether or not the accused defense counsel were ineffective for waiving objection to the duration of the seizure for all of the devices. Now, claims of ineffectiveness require the accused to establish deficient performance by trial defense and prejudice resulting from that deficiency. If the deficient performance claim is based on failure to make a particular motion, then the accused further needs to show a reasonable probability that the unfiled motion would have been meritorious. The majority of CAF resolves this question based on the exclusionary rule, holding that the military judge would not have applied the exclusionary rule even if the delay was unreasonable. The exclusionary rule looks to the deterrence value of excluding the evidence weighed against its cost to the justice system. In balancing these concerns in this case, the deterrence value was low where law enforcement did not deliberately, recklessly, or with gross negligence violate the accused's possessory interest. The court looked to multiple facts to reach this determination, such as the probable cause to support seizure of the iPhone XS, the wife's initial taking of the property, and the accused's failure to request return of the property. The CAF then concluded rather summarily that the cost to the justice system in excluding the evidence would be high because it would result in dismissal of one specification and rehearing on the two others. Judge Maggs, joined by Judge Hardy, provide a concurrence diverging from the majority on why a defense motion lacked a reasonable probability of success. Instead of looking to the exclusionary rule, the concurrence determined the military judge was unlikely to find the continued retention of the devices constituted an unreasonable seizure because the accused failed to request the return of his property prior to it being searched by law enforcement.
So, Andrew, I want to interrupt you. I had just thought about this. We had not talked about this. The CAF kind of hung its hat on the fact that he didn't request the return of property. Do you think then that this imposes some kind of duty on the accused to request the return of property? Or do you think it's just part of the totality of the circumstances analysis?
I think it's part of the totality of the circumstances analysis. I also think for an accused, or I guess more importantly for defense counsel, that you should be making this request.
Sure, yeah.
And while that might not be the top takeaway from what CAF is saying, if you kind of boil down all of their analysis, I think it was dramatically important for the concurrence, but also important for the majority. And the majority indicates that this was not dispositive, but it is a factor to consider. And I think it is a very important factor to consider as well, because at the end of the day, they had evidence of contraband on the 10S. So I don't think that that would have had to be returned. But the wife collected so many devices and didn't provide any type of particularity or kind of extrinsic indication that she as a private person had reviewed these devices or to say what that they are. So for a lot of the devices, they probably were far short of probable cause and they would have had to return those devices.
Well, and what was interesting to me is as I was going through and reading the facts, maybe I missed it, but there wasn't really that sort of nexus between this in-home security system and like literally all of these devices, right? So there, we knew that there were these images on this 10S, but she collected literally everything else. And there was no indication that like, was it an app? Like I didn't see anything in the facts that like sort of indicated that unless he had put them on there, that these images would have been inherently or like put on this device without him doing it. What you said made me think of the fact that there was really, as far as I'm aware, just from reading this opinion, there was not really reason to believe that they were on all of these other devices.
No, yeah. Just that he had multiple devices. I think it was determined that at least the home security app was on these three devices.
Okay, yep.
So whether it was the accused deliberately transferring the files or if it's done through some automatic mechanism by putting the app on these particular devices, that's one thing. But especially outside of these three devices, really no indication other than the wife going through the devices themselves, which if I'm remembering the facts correctly, it was only the 10S and the iPad 4 that she personally had.
I think so. Anyway, I interrupted you. So for practitioners arguing ineffectiveness claims,
sure. I think one of the big takeaways is that even though the Fourth Amendment issues can certainly be complicated, the nuance between the majority and the concurrence really highlights that reasonable minds can differ in finding the dispositive step in the analysis. So for practitioners arguing an ineffectiveness claim based on failure to file a motion, this is compounded even more when trying to argue through a lens of how a military judge was likely to rule at trial. In making these arguments in the future, I'll note that CAF in this case looked at how the CCA decided the issues to assess the cost to the justice system. However, consider that the Supreme Court in Herring, which was cited by CAF, said that the principal cost of applying the exclusionary rule is letting guilty and possibly dangerous defendants go free, something that offends basic concepts of the criminal justice system, particularly in the context of evaluating how a trial judge would have applied the exclusionary rule. There may be room for future appellate practitioners to advocate for further clarification of what costs should be considered in the analysis.
Yeah, because that's one of the things that we have talked about and I've talked about with a variety of audiences is that if you look at Latin, which does this same analysis, it provides that the government has to prove by a preponderance, but it really doesn't give us a really good framework to say, okay, what is the cost of the justice system? And in this case, Parberth, the CAF cites, I can't remember what case it was, but essentially the CAF cites a case that says that the exclusionary rule should be the last remedy because it is such an extreme remedy that the exclusionary rule should be the last remedy that the court applies. And so it has been, you know, we had Latin and then we have this case where the CAF gives us facts and does some analysis, but I don't think gives trial courts, either judges or practitioners, like a really good way to say, okay, this would be prejudicial to the military justice system versus not. And keep in mind, listeners, that if you look at MRE 311 alpha, the exclusionary rule should only be applied if the deterrent effect is going to outweigh the detriment or harm to the justice system. Because essentially, remember, and I know I've talked about this in class and on this podcast before, remember the exclusionary rule is the enforcement mechanism for the Fourth Amendment. And so if it's not going to deter police misconduct, then we shouldn't apply it because it leads to cases going away, it leads to charges going away. But again, to your point, Andrew, how do we actually go about doing this? What are costs to the justice system? Is it just cases going away, right? How do we make that analysis? So
I think if you're at the trial level, and what might be unhelpful from this case is you don't know how the CCA is going to roll.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't rely on the analysis that CAF did here to look at, well, the CCA would dismiss this or order rehearing on that offense. Instead, I think you have to look back to Herring, at least if you're the government, mm-hmm. you're going to be arguing, well, this offense would go away, which otherwise, if we considered this evidence that might be excluded, the accused would be convicted of the offense and they would and should go to prison and serve confinement for, and that's the cost to the justice system. So more grounding it in the consequences as to whether or not the conviction or an acquittal would result, or I guess the case would be unprosecuted mm-hmm. if that evidence was suppressed. I guess it strikes me, and I know that there is the exclusionary rule, but there's just a general feeling when the Fourth Amendment is violated that the expectation is that it's going to get excluded.
Mm-hmm.
From what CAF is saying in this case, that I guess shouldn't be yep. the case, that this should be a matter of last resort that we're excluding evidence. And if you were to look at Herring and you were to look at that principle that it's a measure of last resort, then maybe you're only excluding this evidence when the cost is low because you have other evidence already.
Sure.
And that could be a situation. But then the exclusionary rule doesn't have a lot of bite to it
right.
from a deterrent standpoint mm-hmm. because the conviction is likely to still result.
Well, and one of the things I struggle with, is it the type of crime, right? Do we view lesser crimes as like having less of an impact on the justice system? I mean, I don't know. I don't think so, right? Because the exclusionary rule shouldn't be dictated in any way, shape, or form by the magnitude of the harm, the alleged harm.
I think there's a harder aspect to that, too. Then you're vesting a lot of discretion in individuals to decide what is a worse crime.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And you could use some type of objective measure to say, well, this is the maximum punitive exposure mm-hmm. for this offense, or you might just get into more generalized argument from counsel. And then even then, I think applying the standard gets harder and mm-hmm. harder and subject to just individual discretion.
Yeah. Well, so I think all of that esoteric discussion aside, I think the takeaway for practitioners is to remember that the exclusionary rule isn't automatic. And last resort was what I was looking for. Thank you for saying it. Anyway, that the exclusionary rule is not automatic and that it is actually part of the analysis in MRE 311 that you have to go through, that it's not just like a sort of, okay, well, it violated the Fourth Amendment and therefore it is going to be excluded. No, no, no. According to the military rules of evidence, we still have to do this analysis that comes from Herring, which is a Supreme Court case. So all that is to say that practitioners need to be very cognizant of this, read Harberth, read Latin, and sort of understand that this is an argument you're going to have to make. And from, you know, Andrew makes a great point that the perspective that they have in Harberth is kind of an interesting one in that they take the perspective of how this would have been impacted on appeal as opposed at the trial level. So something for practitioners to be aware of. But anyway, is there anything else that we need to add?
I will just hit on the same point that we were making earlier, and it's kind of an undercurrent to this case. But if you have a situation where evidence is being taken by a third party and given to law enforcement, the right move on the defense end is to immediately request return of that property. And maybe they have some other basis to withhold it, but you need to make that request to set up these facts to put your client in the best position.
Yep, absolutely. Well, thank you all so much for joining us today. We will catch you next time on CAF Chats.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.